Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. I'm here with my colleague, David Tainter.
Hey, Josh, it's been a minute.
Yeah, it's been a while.
A lot of news since we last were on the air.
I feel like there were, two weeks, maybe 3 weeks. I was on vacation.
Right.
We had a couple other, a couple other of us are on vacation, but we're back now, and we're in a funny news period because actually when I was... I was on vacation with my family for about 8 or 9 days, and during that, we had the Mueller report be delivered to the Department of Justice, a couple days of waiting, and this Barr letter that is now kind of like, that's TM after it, right? we had that, and then everybody was, kind of, the president is out sort of like... high-fiving the world and kind of, kind of beating up his perceived enemies. And even though I will say I thought it was greatly premature, it's certainly true. A lot of Trump's opponents were very crestfallen, like, oh, my God, blah, blah, blah. And now, just in the last 2 or 3 days, you're having people kind of come forward and saying, people who you know, from the direction of the special counsel's office,
right,
with a little kind of fuzziness.
Yeah, it's sort of third hand in a way, right? It's people from Mueller's team apparently talking to other government officials who are in turn talking to reporters, right?
Well, I think there's a mix there of, like, the first piece that came out was from the Times, and I got that piece read like it was largely based on sources at the DOJ and around Bill Barr. And I got the sense that that was sort of trying to get ahead of what they knew was sort of bubbling. There's all sorts of, in some cases, legal, and in other cases, just sort of professional. You want a little, if you're that person, you want a little distance, right? In any case, so this is all moving, pretty rapidly now. And we're going to talk about that today and try to get a sense of what's going on. And we have a guest who's a perfectly timed and positioned guest to tell us about this, Garrett Graff. Let me introduce you. Garrett, how are you doing? You're calling us from Vermont.
I am. Thanks
yeah.
for having me today.
So I know, and we're going to talk about the book a little later in this episode of the podcast. Basically, now you, a number of years ago, you wrote, I think, the biography of Bob Mueller. And then now you have a new ebook, which is called Mueller's War, which is based, as I understand it, interviews that you did with Mueller after the original biography, but before he became special counsel, on his experiences during the Vietnam War. Do I basically have that right?
Exactly. So these are the first time and really the only time he's ever spoken in depth about his formative experience in Vietnam, which I'd never had occasion to use until he became special counsel.
Right. Right. Okay. So we're gonna talk about the book, and but before that, we're gonna mine your brain for every insight we can get on what is going on here and what is the deal with this report and the Barr letter and all this kind of stuff. Before we do that, I have a couple housekeeping messages. Garrett, have you ever are you a cold brew iced coffee fan?
I am a very passionate local hot coffee person here.
Interesting. Okay, you're from a different
tribe
than I am.
It's cold in Vermont, so
yeah. Okay, I get that. It's cold. Anyway, we're very big into cold brew iced coffee, and our sponsor happens to be Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. So do you want to become a true office hero? Treat yourself and your coworkers to the best iced coffee in the country with a 42-serving bag and box from Grady's Cold Brew. Now shipping to 20 states on the East Coast, probably maybe even Vermont. I don't know. We can ask the Grady's folks about that. Now shipping to 20 states on the East Coast, this coffee concentrate pours from a spigot just like boxed wine. So help yourself to cup after cup of Grady's signature New Orleans style flavor, freshly brewed with chicory for just a hint of all natural sweetness. Ready to give it a swirl? Get 20% off your first order at Grady'sColdBrew.com with promo code TPM. That's promo code TPM. Now, in other Grady's news, they were like on Colbert, right? Like the
Queer Eye,
Queer Eye. And like Colbert gave them some Grady's from the, and apparently they weren't quite up to it.
Well, they didn't realize it was a concentrated coffee.
But let's be honest. Is it who at TPM?
I put a little water in mine and then a little milk as well. So yeah.
All right. Well,
sorry.
I put milk in, but I mean, like, it's not, I mean, here's the thing with Grady's Cold Brew. Calling it a concentrate is like a conceit or kind of like an affectation. If you're really a true cold brew iced coffee person, you know, it's not a concentrate. You're just supposed to drink it. But anyway, okay, so that is that. Now, another thing, another special deal closer to home. The way we pay for everything at TPM is through memberships. Becoming a member means you get extra stories that we write, you get fewer ads on the site, you get to post in access to our special members forum, and you get a bunch of other good stuff. But it also means you support our journalism and you support this podcast. This podcast isn't just dropping out of the sky. It's made by TPM Media, which is the huge corporation that publishes the Talking right. Points Memo website. Maybe you're already a member, which is awesome. Maybe you're already a subscriber to Prime, but we have a special offer for podcast listeners only. So, like, don't tell someone who's not listening to the podcast about this deal. This is only for you. You get 20% off an annual TPM Prime membership. And all you have to do is to get to that offer, you go to talkingpointsmemo.com/deal. Talkingpointsmemo.com/deal. And you get this 20% off.
Who wouldn't want that?
Yeah.
Who doesn't want to save a little money?
Everybody wants a deal. Everybody wants to know you're making good use of their money. All right, Garrett. So what is your best guess, knowing Bob Mueller, knowing the, as much as we can know about the sort of the office he put together for this investigation, they have been quiet for 10 days or so, but stuff is starting to kind of dribble out now. What do you think is happening in the background?
I have to say, I'm really astonished at how much Bill Barr has fumbled the rollout of this. Given that presumably everyone has been thinking about how to do this and what form it would take for quite some time now, it's amazing to see how Barr has stumbled his way through, really the last 2 weeks since this report came down. And in part, I think that's tied pretty directly to that top line conclusion letter that he issued last Sunday, where he laid out, that the Mueller was not able to establish a conspiracy, and that Barr decided that he didn't see that there was evidence that supported an obstruction charge. But right from that first start, it was a suspicious letter. It was a three-page memo, really, without the signature blocks on it and without the signatures, and it contained only 65 words from Robert Mueller himself,
right.
None of which even represented a complete sentence.
Right.
And, you know, you guys know as journalists, there's a lot of mischief that you can get up to with partial quotes and partial sentences. And you sort of have to imagine here that this was a case where, you know, even the sentences that Barr was quoting from were more nuanced than Barr was letting on, which was why he was just quoting the partial chunks.
You almost get a sense when you read that like, I imagine people like with like lead gloves handling something radioactive and only like getting like a few, like a chunk of a sentence that we can touch without getting zapped or radiation poisoning or something like that. So yeah, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. You were saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And that when you look at the language that Mueller was using and that Barr was using to summarize Mueller's work, it seems pretty clear that there was a lot of potential ground that Mueller's report could cover, even without bringing criminal charges.
Right.
And what I mean by that is, you know, literally on the obstruction side, it said this report does not exonerate the president. So really the opposite of the total exoneration claim that the president quickly trotted out. And then on the conspiracy side, it notably, didn't say the president, you know, there was no evidence of a conspiracy. It said they weren't able to establish a conspiracy.
Right.
And so, you know, the legal world quite well, you know, lawyers use language very precisely. And that was not Bob Mueller saying, it was unlikely to be Bob Mueller saying this was all completely innocent behavior.
Right.
Because the language that Barr used in describing this was very specific and set a very high bar. And I mean that in sort of two ways. One, Barr defined how Mueller had defined conspiracy and collusion. And that included only dealings with the Russian government.
Right.
And so, you know, you could have had any matter or means of a conspiracy or collusion with non-government officials. You know, let's say Moscow real estate developers.
Right.
Let's say Ukrainian oligarchs that would not have been covered by Mueller's report. And then even once you got into that, the phrasing that it said, this does not establish a conspiracy, what that means is not that covers really absolutely everything on the spectrum from total innocence and nothing but an incredibly weird series of coincidences and misunderstandings up to and including a preponderance of evidence, meaning, more than 51% of the evidence points to a conspiracy, up to and including a clear and consistent evidence of a conspiracy, which would be the civil charge,
right.
Sort of the civil burden of proof, but would still stop short of what would be necessary to bring a criminal charge, which is confidence that beyond a reasonable doubt, using the standards of evidence before a reasonable jury, that you could gain a conviction with 85% certainty. So Bob Mueller could be sitting there saying, I'm 84% sure there was a conspiracy here, but I still don't see a criminal charge that I can bring.
You know, one...
That's just a huge range of behavior, and almost inevitably meant that the actual answer was going to be worse for the president than the victory lap he set out and did last week.
Right. Now, one thing I was, when I saw those sentence fragments, and it sounds like we're talking about when they're called epigraphers. It's kind of historian that looks at, like, you know, letters carved in stones in like, you know, ancient Mesopotamia. We're talking about like these sentence fragments. One of the things that I was tried to do was like, all right, what could I put as the first clause of this sentence? And there's a surprisingly wide variety of things that would make perfect sense and actually would create a logic for using that did not establish, that you could, you know, something to the effect of, while we found the president and his people did all sorts of awful shit, we nonetheless did not establish that there was a conspiracy. Like, establish right. is a very specific, it didn't quite get to that level. We were not able to prove it. And an entire other thing kind of in there was, we think we know, at least with Bob Mueller, that they thought he had some really key information and they were never able to secure his cooperation. So it seems at least plausible that part of the story is they thought there were people who might know more, but they could not get, you know, they could not secure that cooperation. But let me ask you this, because, I mean, I agree with you. It's sort of like, what was Barr thinking, to the extent that there would still be a new, you know, a journalism industry a week later, right? But we also have to admit that, man, for the first like 4 or 5 days, he was killing it. You know, I can't, all sorts of our colleagues out there on Twitter saying, this is the day it all changed for Donald Trump. The cloud is gone. It's really, you know, it's yeah, you know, Mueller said he didn't exonerate him on obstruction, but basically this is, you know, complete exoneration. And I'm not going to call out any names, but these are, I'm not talking about like, you know, hacks who like, you know, do pro-Trump commentary on CNN or something. I mean, like, really serious, good journalists. So it really, it worked very, very well. Again, unless you kind of think like, okay, is this really going to stay secret forever? And is it really possible that, like, even if we assume that it is a, let's assume for the sake of conversation that the collusion part of the report basically says, you know, okay, there's a Trump Tower meeting. There's this, you know, they're kind of talking about a hotel deal. But like at the end of the day, there's just not that much there. Yeah, there's some smoke, there's some bad judgment, but there's just not, you know, not that much there. Even that, even based on like what we just saw in the indictments, that's going to look bad after you're jumping around saying, ah, no collusion, and this was all a hoax. And what is, so how do we, how do we make sense of that? Because I don't, you know, what was Barr thinking?
Yeah, and that's part of what I'm confused by in this. You know, both Barr's rollout of this, you know, even for instance, withholding the total length of the report until really his third letter,
right?
And that, you know, we would have felt very differently if in that first letter, which was actually the second letter, his top line conclusions letter,
right.
he said the
canonical Barr letter TM afterwards. Yes,
exactly. That he said, you know, this is a lengthy, meaty 400-page report that concludes the following, because it the moment you sort of realize how deeply sourced and thorough this document likely is, it makes clear that the answer is likely highly nuanced.
Right.
And particularly, I think it's important to see Mueller's own framing of why he did not choose to make a traditional prosecutorial decision.
Right.
Was that, you know, I've spent a lot of time interviewing Mueller. I've followed his work for a decade very closely. The idea that Bob Mueller decided... decided in his final act of a 50-year public career to not make a decision about the one thing he had been asked to make a decision about because it was just too hard, seems unlike him.
Right.
And so it seems entirely possible and perhaps even probable to me that Bob Mueller always had approached this with the idea that he wasn't going to bring a traditional prosecutorial decision on the obstruction question, because when you get into whether you can charge the president with obstruction, you do, as Barr's letter says, get into complicated questions about fact and law.
Right.
And that Mueller might very well have seen his role as being one focused on being an independent fact finder, using the tools of the criminal justice system to gather evidence that could be turned over to Congress to adjudicate as part of an impeachment process, because that is the body that is constitutionally delineated to deal with questions of presidential malfeasance, that Congress is not held to a bar of whether there is a federal felony that can be established beyond a reasonable doubt. The president can be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors, and that is, you know, almost literally anything that Congress declares it to be.
Right.
So they could look at a situation and say, yeah, this isn't a provable RICO case in federal court, but this is still behavior that we don't believe that a president of the United States should be engaged in. For instance, we do not believe that candidates for president should be encouraged, if they are knowledgeable about a foreign adversary's attack on our democratic system, to not report it, to not do anything about it, and in fact, to welcome it and accept its help.
Right.
That may not be a provable conspiracy, but, you know, that's just sort of something we don't want in our politics.
Right. Sort of the knowing passive recipient model. Like, we know we're
right.
doing it, not taking any overt action, but, like, bring it on. And I'm not going to tell
exactly.
anybody. Let me ask you this. Does this seem, from what you know of Mueller, does this seem plausible, probable? And I think this kind of gets at what you were just talking about, that it seemed to me the most, I mean, as you said, I don't think Bob Barr and the team of people he put together does not seem like a low energy group. Like, they just kind of weren't up to the challenge of making a decision. But that it seems to me that, especially in the obstruction front, in some ways it is an extra prosecutorial judgment that is required. And you put someone like Bob Mueller in charge because he's a fact finder. He's someone who has a lot of investigative experience, law enforcement experience, is dogged, is a sort of a trusted person, or at least, you know, was a trusted person across the partisan divide. But when you get at, you know, is it okay for the president to use his legitimate constitutional powers in clearly corrupt ways? Should all that kind of stuff? It goes beyond what a prosecutor has unique insight on. Does that seem consistent with the man you've gotten to know and interviewed?
Yeah, and that, you know, one way that Mueller might have approached this is everyone short of the president is game for traditional prosecution, and the president himself, I'm going to operate under the longstanding Justice Department policy that the president is not indictable by the executive branch while in office, and instead I'm going to use I've been tasked by the Justice Department to gather evidence that could be turned over to Congress, and that Mueller, in some ways, that is very akin to the role that we ask the intelligence community to play, which is, you know, they are to provide the set of facts that then others look at from a policy perspective, and that And that given that this was in many ways a counterintelligence investigation, that strikes me as potentially a framework that would have made a lot of sense for him to pursue. By the way, there's another aspect to this on the counterintelligence front that I think people have glossed over in the last 2 weeks, which is how the counterintelligence information separate from the Mueller report has been reported to Congress, which is that the FBI has briefed that information to what's called the Gang of Eight, which is the four leaders of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, and then the four leaders of the House and the Senate. And
now that has, I remember when they said they offered, that has happened now?
Now that you mentioned, I've lost track of whether that.
But they definitely offered, and presumably they'll take them up on it.
Yes. And we wouldn't, I'm not even sure necessarily know if and when it has happened.
Right.
But that's a significant development in its own way, because the Gang of Eight is a unit that is delineated in statute to be the recipients of the nation's most sensitive intelligence information. The House and the Senate Intelligence Committees, as a routine basis, receive all sorts of intelligence information. And it's only stuff that is even more sensitive than that that can will be shared only with the Gang of Eight. And what that often means is that the Gang of Eight is being briefed on ongoing operations. Like, the Gang of Eight are the people that you call and say, we're going after bin Laden tonight. We have operators in the air right now to kill or capture bin Laden. And that is an instance where the fact that the FBI is only willing to brief the Gang of Eight and not the full House and Senate Intelligence Committees says to me that there's something ongoing about this counterintelligence investigation that is worth paying attention to. That there is either ongoing signs of activity in this space that's particularly sensitive. There's ongoing involvement, possibly, of U.S. persons is another thing that it could mean. But that there's something weird going on the counterintelligence side of the Russia investigation that remains too sensitive to share, as would be routine, with the full House and Senate Intelligence Committees. And I think that that's another aspect of this that's worth paying attention to as we await the full Mueller report, is that there's this whole other aspect to it that we won't ever see publicly, mm-hmm. but that is playing out, and that there's plenty of reason to believe is still suspicious.
And I guess that even though the Gang of Eight, and in this case probably the Democrats among, you know, the four Democrats, even though we probably will never know what they are told, inescapably it will inform their attitude, or could inform their attitude towards the report and the necessity of making it. You know what I'm saying? That if, you know, if it
Absolutely.
Comes out, they say, like, you know, the Russians still seem to have Donald Trump under some sort of, you know, pressure or something like that. I mean, I'm just putting that out as a hypothetical. That's going to make them look a lot more seriously in what's included in the report. And it's funny that when we were in that few days of sort of, you know, no collusion, no obstruction, I'm vindicated, blah, 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 even if you accept that on, you know, on its face, just as a thinking person, you're still left with, what was that Helsinki thing about? Like, what was going
right.
on there? Like, if you know, because clearly something was not right. And whether or not there was a criminal conspiracy is sort of an entirely different question. But like, something is up there. So let's shift to another question. And this is something where I think knowing Mueller is so key. The reports that we have seen so far basically seem to say some subset of the people who worked in the special counsel's office are disgruntled and they're talking. Okay.
And in that range of people, you've got a number of, I think, about 19 or 20 lawyers, about 40 FBI, officials. Some of those people are still in government. Some are now out of government, which, you know, kind of makes it a little easier for them to talk. But in the background is Mueller. Now, I would assume that, well, I don't want to assume too much because I don't know the guy. Where do you think, where, think out loud for us, based on what you know of him, where he figures in to what seems to be unfolding right now, which is to say that people who know what's in that report do not feel like Bill Barr accurately conveyed to the public what's going on. Where do you think he would figure in that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have to assume that Mueller believes, probably rightly, that the full report or most of the report will come out in the near future, and that, you know, we'll clear the air when that happens. Mm-hmm. I don't think Mueller is someone who worries a lot about his reputation or his legacy on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
He is not a Trump White House aide who realizes if you have 17 consecutive bad hours, you might be fired the next time you go to the bathroom.
Right, right.
Mueller has, weathered 2.5 years, 2 years of work. The investigation has been 2.5 years, but Mueller's role has been 2, really. And has done so utterly silently, by his own choice.
Right.
Ken Starr used to give briefings at the end of his driveway every day.
I remember
about how his investigation was going. And Mueller has never uttered a word publicly in his role as special counsel. And the few times that he has had announcements worthy of a public appearance, Rod Rosenstein has stepped out to do those for him. And so, I think that Mueller is probably continuing his life and sure that everything will sort itself out.
As someone who's talked to Bob Mueller, you know, at length, one of the things I've always kind of been curious about him, this is kind of a small thing, but his choice to basically only wear like a white button-up dress shirt, right, to kind of create this appearance that he's totally neutral. He doesn't want to come off as, I don't know if it's, tilted one way or the other. Does that come from his military background, do you think? I mean, I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah, so that's actually a great question, and I couldn't have teed you up any better if I had been trying to feed you a question. The answer about why Bob Mueller wears his white shirt is literally the most interesting thing I've ever heard Bob Mueller say. And he was infamous as FBI director for wearing these white shirts and really insisting that his deputies and assistant directors around him wear white shirts. And he would, in a good-natured manner, tease anyone who dared to come in with something like a blue shirt or, God forbid, a pink shirt. And he, this became sort of lore around him as FBI director, such that, the first time I met him when I was writing about him in 2008, I knew that I was going to see him that day, and I wore a white shirt and joked about it with him. And I said, I knew I was going to see you today, and I wore a white shirt. Years after he was FBI director, I finally asked him at one point, dude, what was the deal with the white shirts all the time? And he said, Robert, he became FBI director on September 4th, 2001, 1 week before 9/11. And he said about the white shirts, I knew that I was leading the FBI through the most wrenching change in its history. As he made remade the FBI from a domestic law enforcement agency into an international intelligence agency, you know, as he shifted all of these resources from criminal work to counterterrorism work and brought in this whole new cadre of intelligence analysts to help process the information, help agents work better, and really modernize the FBI for a new century of threats. And he said, you know, I wore a white shirt every day in order to signal to the FBI workforce that this was still the FBI that they had joined, that the dark suit and the white shirt has been the FBI uniform since the day of J. Edgar Hoover, and that I wanted them, even as we were undergoing all of this change, to be able to look at the uniform that I wore every day and know that it was still the thing that they had signed up to serve. And I thought it was just such a fascinating answer to me in terms of his approach to the work and the way, and sort of evidence of how deeply he had thought about the institution that he was leading.
So the new book, it's Mueller's War, and it's out as an ebook, I think, this week. And as we said at the front, it's based on interviews you did before he took on the special counsel role, but after the biography you wrote. So tell us now, I think a good bit of the premise here is that this is his formative life experience, his time serving in Vietnam. Tell us about what you learned and what the book is about.
Yeah, so the book tells the story of the year that he served in Vietnam. He graduated from Princeton in 1966 at a time when there was not, if you were a wealthy white man coming out of an Ivy League school, you didn't generally have to go to Vietnam. And he wanted to, and he signed up to serve, and he signed up to serve really in the just about the hardest possible way, which was as a Marine infantry fighting along the DMZ with the Marine maneuver battalions. And Mueller, in many ways, this was the formative experience of his life. And it's something that shaped who he is in ways big and small, both his sense of duty and honor, down to literally the way that he wears his watch. He still wears his watch on the inside of his wrist, which is the way that the Marines teach you so that you avoid accidentally flashing someone with your watch if it catches in the sun on the battlefield. And so this was an incredibly important experience for him, and one that he really excelled at in ways that are, I think, sort of interesting and surprising. He did so well in officer candidate school that he was sent on to Army Ranger School, one of the only Marines in the entire country sent on to Army Ranger School, that really tough survival course in Fort Benning, Georgia. And then he was sent off to Vietnam in the fall of 1968 after the Tet Offensive into some of the fiercest fighting that the U.S. faced in the entire Vietnam War. He arrived as the leader of 2nd Platoon Hotel Company, 2nd Battalion, 4th Marine Regiment in Quang Tri Province, right along the DMZ in November 1968. And that was a time when there were 500,000 Americans in Vietnam. That was the peak of American involvement in Vietnam. And yet, 80% of all of the casualties among that entire population were coming out of just the 25,000 Marines in those maneuver battalions along the DMZ. I mean, it was incredibly fierce, hard fighting against the North Vietnamese Army. And this was where Mueller did 6 months of combat, where he established himself as a very able leader, very respected leader, and literally very cool and collected under fire. He received a Bronze Star with Valor for his leadership in the Battle of Mutter's Ridge in December 1968, where he helped rescue two wounded Marines, one of them mortally wounded, and bring them back to American lines. And then in April 1969, so 50 years ago this month, actually, he himself was shot during an ambush of a platoon that his platoon was raced into battle to help. And he was shot through the leg by an AK-47, medevaced out of the jungle, and finished out his one-year tour working with a Marine commander on the staff there in Vietnam. And Mueller really loved being a Marine and thought at one point of making a career out of being a Marine. And it has that experience has given him this incredible sense of perspective that he talks about in how, you know, I think one of the things a lot of people misunderstand about him is he says he's never done anything and will never do anything again as hard as leading men in combat in Vietnam. And so leading the special counsel's office, you know, this incredibly important, politically charged investigation, potentially, you know, the most politically charged investigation in the history of American politics. I think probably from Bob Mueller's perspective is no more than the third hardest job he's ever had in his life, that he, you know, certainly after leading men in Vietnam and then, you know, after leading the FBI post 9/11. So I think he brings to this role just this incredible perspective and grounding in ways that is, you know, frankly puzzling to a lot of people who don't know him well.
Yeah, I suppose he's not going to be intimidated by a few Trump tweets compared to, you know, serving in combat.
Well, I would also think that probably means that he's not going to lose too much sleep if we go a couple, you know, several news cycles with Trump crowing about being totally vindicated. He's not going to lose a great deal of sleep over that. Is there anything else from that, from those interviews and that, you know, kind of talking to him about that part of his life that gives you a sort of additional perspective into how this investigation has gone? Just as a kind of a last question to frame this up. I take your point though, the kind of the sort of impassive nature of his behavior during this investigation is maybe the most obvious thing of not getting baited by Trump, not, you know, just kind of whatever, you know, talk.
Yeah, and I think that Mueller has realized that sort of the one thing that is holding this investigation together is Mueller's integrity and his view, you know, the view of him in Washington that he is someone who is and always has been above day-to-day politics.
Right.
And in some ways, by the way, I think that that's the only reason that people put real stock in Barr's letter to begin with, was the idea that, you know, Mueller could be trusted to have completed a thorough investigation. And if Mueller said there was no there there,
right,
then there's no there there.
Right.
And that, you know, in some ways, the nuclear option that has always existed for Bob Mueller has been to say, you know, however quietly or publicly, you know, I wasn't able to do the investigation I wanted to do, or that's not what my investigation found.
Right.
And that in some ways, the fact that we are seeing rumblings of the latter, you know, should really give us pause to let's wait and see what Mueller has said himself about the work that he's done.
Right. So, okay, so the book is Mueller's War. Where can people buy it? Because this is something you go on Amazon and it's going to be, it's out this week. Is it available now? How do people want to pick it up? How do they do it?
It's available now through the web publisher Scribd.
Okay.
The website Scribd, Scribd.com, and they have a new program of publishing original journalism, sort of, and this is one of the first Scribd originals.
Cool, cool. All right, so you go to Scribd.com and you can buy it there. I want to remind everybody else that there's other commerce to be had here. Remember, Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee is a sponsor of the Josh Marshall Podcast. Ready to give it a swirl? Get 20% off your first order at Grady'sColdBrew.com with promo code TPM. That's promo code TPM. Also remember, special 20% off Prime memberships for only, absolutely only for podcast listeners. Go to talkingpointsmemo.com/deal for that. And Garrett, thank you so much. I've been reading your writing for a very long time and always interested, especially on the Mueller front, what you have to say. So thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's great to talk to you.
All right. Thanks so much. And we will talk to everybody else in a week.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding right your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.